Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. This is Cale Clark, and this is The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. Welcome back to the program. So glad that you're with me today. As we were looking at the book of Exodus, we left off at really the most dramatic moment in the eyes of some in the entire book. And this is God about to part the Red Sea so that the Israelites can walk through on dry land, and the Egyptian army and Pharaoh will be destroyed. And as we talked about in our last episode, when we were looking at the beginning of chapter 14, God was really leading the Israelites and Pharaoh and the Egyptians into a trap. Their backs were against the wall. Their backs were against the water of the Red Sea, and the Egyptian army's closing in, the finest fighting force in the world, this world superpower. And this was a test. This was an absolute test for the Israelites, a test of faith. It was going to force them to trust in God because they were up against an impassable situation and an impossible situation as well. But for Pharaoh and the Egyptians, it would indeed be a trap that would lead them to their doom. And right now, the only thing protecting, the only thing between the Egyptians and the Israelites is the Shekinah glory of God, this pillar of fire and cloud. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But here's the thing about tests of faith. It really reveals what is there. It's an examination. It's a little bit like the game of golf. It's often said that golf isn't so much a test of character as a revealer of character. And this is what had to happen for the Israelites. The quality of their faith had to be laid bare. And sometimes God does this in our life. He gives us an intractable problem that we can't solve on our own. Just like when Israel was trapped up against the Red Sea, only God could get them out of that jam. They were really kind of in a privileged situation. If you're really, really walking with God, if you're really attuned spiritually, you'll actually look forward to those situations when you're in a jam. Because you'll be like, I can't wait to see what God is going to do here. Because he's going to act. He will act. But that most of the time we're worried, we're anxious, we don't know what to do, we feel trapped. And so it's a great chance for us to grow in faith. It's a good chance for us to get that supernatural perspective, to look forward to those events. And that can really only happen when we've had these experiences. And that's going to be the great fruit of really the Israelites getting through the Red Sea, is that they're going to be able to trust in God more. Does it mean that they're super mature? No. They're going to have their problems. They're going to have their issues no matter what. And we'll see that as we go along through Exodus. But this is really the end of the first half of the book, because the first half of Exodus is about the power of God, these incredibly miraculous plagues, the power from heaven that God sends to get the Israelites out of Egypt. The Red Sea crossing is really the last big thing there. And then there's going to be the second half of the book, the presence of God. Israelites are going to have to learn how to live with God in the wilderness and how to form that relationship, how to grow. So let's pick up our Bibles and pick up where we left off. Going to pick it up in Exodus chapter 14, starting with verse 15. The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. Lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the sons of Israel may go on dry ground through the sea, and I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." Then the angel of God who went before the host of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness, and the night passed without one coming near the other all night. Okay, let's stop there for just 1 second. It's interesting. The writer talks about the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. It's almost like the heavenly host, the angels. It's really, these are military terms, really the armies of Egypt, the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. What's coming between them? The cloud and the pillar. I also want to look at verse 20. Now, in the Bible version that I'm reading from, which is the Revised Standard Version, Second Catholic Edition, RSV 2CE, that's how it's abbreviated. It says in verse 20 that the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. Here's verse 20, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel, and there was the cloud and the darkness, and the night passed without one coming near the other all night. Now, I'm going to read you verse 20 from a different translation because it brings out something interesting about this. This is from the New International Version. This is how it renders verse 20. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to one side and light to the other side. So neither went near the other all night long. That's very interesting to me from a spiritual perspective. Obviously, the angel of the Lord, the angel of God, travels in front of the army of Israel, leading them through the daytime, this pillar of cloud. And that cloud would provide a lot of shade for the Israelites, the desert heat. And then at nighttime, it would be, of course, this pillar of fire to lead them, give them light so they could see where they're going, and also to warm them because it gets cold in the desert at night. And this could have been just a magnificent sight, several miles high, maybe a couple of miles wide. It would have had to have been quite massive in order to do this task. And so, really, this is representative of the very presence of God. And it's kind of interesting that when the cloud moves from in front of the Israelites to behind them, it kind of separating the armies of Israel from the advancing armies of Pharaoh, the Egyptians. Why? Because it's not time yet. It's not time for God to show his hand in that climactic battle and swallow up the Egyptians in the sea. It's going to happen soon. But God's timing, we always have to wait on God's timing. And then this idea that the cloud, you know, becomes fire at night, cloud in the day, but it seems like right now, it's interesting how it's kind of a little bit of both. Fire on the one side, light on one side, and then darkness, this cloud of deep darkness on the other side. And the Egyptians can't see where they're going. Light on one side, darkness on the other. This reminds me an awful lot about how people react to Jesus. Obviously, the very presence of God in Jesus, the incarnation, God made man. Some see light, some see darkness. This is exactly what happens when you look at John's gospel. I want to read to you from the beginning of John's gospel, and John certainly has the Exodus in mind as he's writing this. This is what's called the prologue of John's gospel. Let's look at John chapter 1, verse 1, if you want to open up your Bible to that passage. Well, here's what it says. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, obviously, he's hearkening back to the very first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, which is really part one of Exodus. Part two is the book of Exodus itself. This is all kind of one motif, the books of Moses. But in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Obviously, that's how the book of Genesis starts off, in the beginning. Verse 2 of John chapter 1, he was in the beginning with God. Verse 3, all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Now let's look at verse 4. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, verse 5, and the darkness has not overcome it. So this idea of light, and that's exactly what happens again in the book of Genesis. There is light, right? There is light and darkness. Let there be light. Well, Jesus really is the light. And the darkness, it says, light shining in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. In some translations, it says the darkness has not understood it. has not understood it. And the Egyptians are kind of the personification of those who don't understand the light of God. Despite all the great miracles that Yahweh has done, the plagues showing his power, how foolish are they to fight against him, to try to go after him one last time, try to recapture the Israelites. Let's go back to John's gospel for a second, the beginning of John. It says, there was a man sent from God whose name was John. This is John the Baptist, of course. He came for testimony to bear witness to the light that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness to the light. The true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world. That's Jesus, of course. It says he was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world knew him not. Wow. It's incredible. He came to his own home, and his own people received him not. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave the power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh. This is John 1:14, very famous verse. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. We have beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten Son from the Father. So this idea of Jesus as that light and the different reactions that people have to the light, I just find that that's very interesting in light of, no pun intended, the light, the darkness, the pillar of fire, the pillar of cloud separating the Egyptians from the Israelites. Now, again, there were some Egyptians who actually came with the Israelites. They saw the light, as it were. And they said, we want to go with you. We see that your God is the one true and living God. We want to come with you on this journey. So, but nonetheless, this is instructive as we go through. Another place where you see Jesus as the light is in John chapter 8 and 9. Now, this is, of course, the Feast of Tabernacles, or it's also known as the Feast of Booths. And this has, again, so much to do with the book of Exodus. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. So one thing is, when you read John's gospel, John is very fond of these dualisms, light versus darkness, you know, life versus death, truth versus lies, knowledge against ignorance, freedom versus slavery. The contrast is always there. So this is what Jesus says in John chapter 8. This is at the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles. And by the way, this is, again, the journey of the Israelites through the wilderness when they lived in tents. The people of God, during this feast, they would live in these tents around the temple for an 8-day period. So this is what Jesus says in John chapter 8, verse 12. I am the light of the world. This is one of the famous I am sayings of Jesus. I am the door. I am the way, the truth, and the life. He says, I am the light of the world. So Jesus is the light of the world. Now, that's good news for some people, because he's going to show the way. That's one of the things that light does for us. Lights up the next step, the direction that we should go. But for others, light isn't good news. As scripture says, some people don't want to come into the light because their deeds are evil. Think about criminals. The last thing they want is a floodlight spotlighting what they're doing. And so they'd rather just remain in the darkness. Now, what's truly intriguing about this, when we talk about the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, is that at the end of every day at that feast, there was an amazing ceremony that took place in the temple, in the court of the women. There's the court of the Gentiles, the court of the women. There are certain boundaries where people could go and couldn't go. And in the court of the women, there were massive lamps. There were four enormous lamps, and each one of them had about 65 liters of oil. They're just gigantic oil lamps. Now, what did they use for the wicks? I mean, if the lamps were this big, how'd they light them? Well, they would take robes of the priests of the temple that were no longer in use, and they would kind of tie them together and make these enormous wicks for these enormous oil lamps, and it would light them on fire. And the Jewish Mishnah says this, quote, there was no courtyard in Jerusalem which was not made bright by the light, end of quote. So these four lamps really did an incredible job of lighting up the night. And again, why did they do this? It's to recall the pillar of fire that lit the way for the Israelites at night. And people would take torches. They would dance and sing very joyfully throughout the nights of this great Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths. This was God's presence with them in that pillar of fire during the Exodus journey. And that's where Jesus says, in this feast, and Jesus has a sense of what he's doing here. This is the moment. He says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And then what does he do in the very next chapter? In chapter 9, again, this is at the same feast. He heals a blind man, a man who was born blind. He says, I am the light of the world. When he heals him, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. So this is what he's bringing about, not just for his fellow Israelites, but also for all the peoples of the world, universal, Catholic. This is a second exodus that Jesus is bringing out of the darkness of sin and death, slavery to sin. Just like the Israelites were slaves to Pharaoh, he's going to set them free and lead us to the promised land of heaven. That's what it's all about. And we're part of that too. We're part of that. And when you read chapter 9 in John's gospel, we'll have to maybe deal with this another time, but one of the things that Jesus says is that we must do the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. So Jesus says this to others who are there. And so that's you and me. We have to participate in this work of Jesus to bring this light to others. We must do the work of him who has sent me. And that's exactly what happens. And by the way, even how he heals this guy, the man born blind, is incredibly interesting. He sends him to this place called the Pool of Siloam to wash. And by the way, the word Siloam means sent. So Jesus sends him there. He sends us out into the world as well to bring about healing. And don't forget what he says in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 5, verse 14. Jesus says, you are the light of the world. Yeah, he's the light of the world. But he also says, you and I are the light of the world. It's like at the Easter vigil, the Christ candle. What is that? What happens there? The Christ candle lights all the small candles of everybody in the congregation. We spread that light around. We are that light of Christ collectively as the church, as the body of Christ. So he sends us out into the world. And it's a very sacramental healing, by the way, this man born blind. What does Jesus do? He uses some saliva to heal this guy. And so he uses created matter to bring about his grace and his power. It's kind of what happens too, even with his incarnate body. He's using created manner of a human body. And he gets this, of course, from Our Lady in order to bring about the healing of the world. So it's really intriguing to read this and to think about this and how this light that divides is so, it's revelatory because it reveals not only the light of Christ, but what is in each person, how they respond. It's like the parables, what's in the heart. They respond if they're open to that light of Christ. It's their hearts, the light going out or getting put out, if you will. So that's intriguing. And we'll pick up this again as we continue to look at Exodus, the crossing of the Red Sea. Or is it the Reed Sea? We'll think about this next time, because some scholars want to suggest this wasn't really a sea. This is just kind of a marshland with just a couple of inches of water. This wasn't a big deal at all. Is that really what happened? We'll talk about that in the next episode of The Faith Explained as we continue with the Exodus journey. But we're not done yet. Hey, let's open up The Faith Explained Q&A mailbag right now. Okay, as we open up our Q&A mailbag, I want to remind you that you also can get to me, get your question to me. You can email me, faith@relevantradio.com is the address, faith, F-A-I-T-H @relevantradio.com. And today's question comes to us via email, and it's from Katie in San Bernardino, California, and she's listening on Apple Podcasts. That's something to remember, that our shows are always put out as podcasts on all the major providers as well as on the Relevant Radio app. And if you are listening on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, won't you be so kind as to give us a 5-star review and a nice note? Helps other people to discover the programs. All right. So Katie's question is this. Hi, Kale. My question is, did Jesus realize that he was fully God and fully man? Okay, that's a very good question. I would say that yes, the answer is yes, he did know. Now, we've done a couple of episodes in the past on the Faith Explained on Jesus' self-understanding as Messiah. Who did he think that he was? Did he realize his divinity? It's not something the church made up later. Now, of course, the church does define the faith very specifically, that he is 100% God, 100% human as well. He is the God-man. This is what the incarnation is all about. And it's very difficult to think about the incarnation in one sense, because how did that all kind of blend together? And at what point was Jesus conscious of this? These are all amazing questions that we can maybe ask our Lord in heaven one day, please God. But we do have to, I think, understand that the Jesus' humanity is incredibly important. I'll talk about his self-understanding with respect to his divinity in just a minute, but I think a lot of Catholics and other Christians are, when it comes down to it, they may not realize this, but the way that they think, they're almost like docetists. Now the docetic heresy was basically all about this idea that Jesus wasn't really fully human. It was kind of a phantasm. There were Gnostics. It's an ancient heresy that still persists today. This idea that Jesus wasn't real. He wasn't really human. A lot of Christians, although they might not think that they buy into that heresy, after all, they say the creed every Sunday when they go to Mass. They say what they believe. But in practical terms, a lot of people treat Jesus as if he is divinity simply wearing a mask, kind of faking it when it comes to his humanity. He's not really hungry. How could he possibly be hungry? He's God. How could he possibly be tempted? So when you lose the full humanity of Jesus, you get a pretty superficial understanding of what he was all about. But again, how that all worked out is intriguing to think about. When did he learn how to read? He had to learn how to read. He wasn't born in Bethlehem and then could recite the scriptures in Hebrew 3 days later. He had to learn how to speak, learn how to read, just like everybody else, as he grew up. And it's intriguing to think about what the letter to the Hebrews says, by the way. In Hebrews chapter 5, verse 8, it says, although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. Now, hang on here. How can Jesus learn anything if he's God? How can he learn obedience from what he suffered? Well, doesn't he already know everything? Well, he had to learn it experientially in his human nature, because that's something that he didn't always have. At a point in time, he became incarnate. And so he experienced all these things. That's why he can understand us, and we can trust in him that he knows what we're going through. As it says earlier in the letter to the Hebrews, in the prior chapter 4, it says, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet was without sin. So he understands what we're going through. And I know some people, I remember C.S. Lewis saying something about this in one of his writings. He said, yeah, some people say, well, wasn't it easier for Jesus to deal with the temptation because he's the God-man? Well, maybe, but so what? It doesn't matter. He still understands what it's like to go through all this stuff, and he can help us too. Now, there's another error as well that people fall into. Some people, you know, in practical terms, they kind of deny the humanity of Christ. Even if they say they believe it with their lips, in practice, they don't really understand the full humanity of Christ. And we can go in the other direction, too. There's another group of heretics in the early church called the Ebionites. And the Ebionites basically denied the divinity of Christ. They didn't believe he was really God. And so That's an error that we don't fall into as well. So, did Jesus know himself to be God? Yes, I do believe that he did. Absolutely. And one of the reasons why we can see this, there's so many things we could say about this. Jesus is doing things that only God can do, forgiving sins, controlling nature, saying that the eternal destiny of people is really based on how they respond to him. There's so many things that could be said, but one big clue is right before Jesus died, when he's on trial before the high priest Caiaphas, and he is asked, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" This is how Jesus responded. This is in Mark 14, verse 62. He says, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One," or the power, that's a reference to God, "and coming on the clouds of heaven." So when he says sitting at the right hand, that's a reference to Psalm 110, verse 1. "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet." Well, so hold on here. How can he be sitting at the right hand of God and yet also moving, coming with the clouds of heaven? Well, the answer is very simple. This is God's chariot throne with flaming wheels of fire. You know, he's coming in judgment on the clouds of heaven. And so this is why the high priest says, "Blasphemy." You're basically saying, "I am the co-regent of the Father. I am reigning with God. I'm sitting on his throne." This is a clear claim to divinity. And that's why he tears his robes and condemns him to death. Now, if he had said, "Well, I'm just a messenger of God. I'm just a prophet," you know, he probably would have got beaten up, but they wouldn't have tried to kill him. So this is something they clearly understood to be worthy of death, that Jesus thought he was God. And that's one of the reasons why the early Christians preached him as God the Son right from the very beginning, because that's exactly what they believed even before Jesus went to the cross, even before he was resurrected. This is what Jesus understood about himself. And so I do believe, in answer to your question, Katie, I do believe that Jesus knew he was fully God and fully man. How that worked out in terms of the incarnation, how he experienced it as he went through life, is a great mystery in some ways, but the truth is there, and this is part of the truth of our Catholic faith. Now, if you have a question, if you're listening and you have a question, you can also email me, faith@relevantradio.com. And don't forget, you can also get your question to me through Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And I look forward to talking to all of you in the next episode of The Faith Explained. Until next time, God bless you. Peace.